dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I have come to regard as one of the greatest sources of intelligence, in the applied sense, most especially, is our first and only guest for this very important hour of conversation. His name is David Yerushalmi. He is an outstanding attorney and litigator by training, advocation, and practice. He is the founder, with his colleague Robert Muse, of an indispensable organization, the American Freedom Law Center. He is the general counsel of the Center for Security Policy, for which I am eternally grateful, a dear friend, and truly one of the most remarkable men I've ever met. And it is a delight to be able to spend this hour talking with him about his work and about the nature of the need for it, now more than ever, arguably, and the dangers if the kinds of efforts he's making to preserve our freedoms are allowed to prevail. And I welcome, for all of these purposes, to our microphones, David Yerushalmi. It's good to have you with us, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Well, Frank, it's great to be with you, and I'm blushing from that introduction, but I will say this, that the work that we've done has been stepped up and is measurably better by the partnership that we've had with you and the Center for Security Policy.
Well, thank you. I second that, and I'm gratified by both what we've done and by your appreciation of its importance. Give us a little bit of background on who you are, what you have done to this point, and why you've taken on this extraordinary challenge of litigating on behalf of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and, well, our Constitution more generally, David.
Well, I'm, as you indicated, I am an attorney and a litigator by training and by profession. I've been litigating now close to 40 years. You and I go back, having first met in the 80s, but I won't go back that far. When 9/11 occurred, I was actually in Israel, and I had been general counsel for a think tank that operated in Jerusalem and in Washington, D.C. And at that point in time, I understood what many people understood, and that is that most of us who worked in the national security field, and as an attorney, much of my work was involved with public policy, national security law, dealing with the intersection of national security and public policy with the courts. And we realized that we had been wrong about the Palestinian-Israel conflict. That is to say that most of us had looked at that problem as a political problem, as a dispute between two people seeking a piece of land and having differences of opinion about who was going to control that property, and understood that there was something deeper. And I and others, but I can speak to my involvement, began to look at carefully the doctrine that underpinned that conflict. And what I found out, and again, others as well, I don't claim any special innovation here, that the doctrine articulated by the Palestinians in its deepest sense was exactly the same as Al-Qaeda's doctrine and its propaganda regarding the attack on 9/11. As we began to look at the doctrine underpinning threats from Islamic groups around the country, around the world, and over the past two decades, we realized that this was not a political conflict. This was deeply religious, that the doctrine that was being espoused by groups around the globe fighting different enemies, whether it's Israel, whether it was the United States as the great Satan, whether it was in Pakistan and India, whether it was in Chechnya, whether it was in China, the Philippines, Lebanon, that all of these groups espoused Sharia, Islamic law, as a doctrine that demanded among its adherents to establish a global caliphate and to do that through three modalities, either through proselytization, dawah, persuasion, through subjugation, dhimmitude, this idea that certain peoples and religions could live side by side with Islam as long as they were prepared to be subjugated. And the third modality, if the first two didn't work, was death through jihad. And it was a very straightforward doctrine. The problem was that it was mind-boggling, because you had an enormous number of adherents of the 1.6 billion Muslims around the globe, most of which live outside the United States. Many of these, and the data that we had, the surveys indicated anywhere from 30 to 70%, depending upon which country was being surveyed, adhered to this doctrine, sometimes devoutly and sometimes in the breach, meaning they themselves personally might not be so religious, but they certainly honored and respected and supported that doctrine. At that point in time, I understood that the battle was going to be back in Washington, D.C., and we moved our forces and our efforts there. And that's where you and I intersected back in the early years of the Gulf War. And we began to look at, together with the Center for Security Policy, the empirical data that would establish a link between Sharia, the doctrine that called for jihad, whether it was global kinetic jihad or a non-kinetic jihad to destroy and tear asunder Western institutions and the civilization writ large. And we cooperated with the Center for Security Policy when we began.
Well, hold the thought, David, just for one second before we go to some of that really interesting history. Just to, you know, tease this out a little bit. You're saying, David Yerushalmi, that this doctrine of Sharia, which is at the core of authoritative Islam, is fundamentally a political doctrine for establishing and exercising power, and that it has religious attributes or patinas, if you will, but that fundamentally it comes down to how can, in the name of Islam, adherents secure dominance over everybody else and wield that domination in a way that will advance further a truly global quest for dominion. Have I got that right?
Exactly. And let's tease out a little nuance here. When I started the tale, as it were, I mentioned that initially back in the 1980s, 1990s, when we were first looking at the Palestinian-Israel conflict, we looked at it as political. What I really mean by that is secular political, just simply a strife over land and political power. And what we discovered after 9/11 is that it was religious. And again, not religious in the sense that we in the West often use that term, but political in the way that you've just described. It was a religious doctrine, a legal doctrine, the adherence of Sharia.
So, David, as you say, this is mind-blowing. It has prompted people who have mostly, let's be honest, been either Islamists or Sharia supremacists or jihadists, whatever term you wish to use, but also people either aligned with them or simply afraid of them, to describe what your analysis has shown as Islamophobia, as some kind of unreasoned fear of Muslims and desire to do them harm in some form or fashion because of that racist or xenophobic attitude. I know you've been branded in this way, as have I, as have many of us who have been fighting against this jihadism. How do you respond to such, well, smears is the way I would put it, but charges or allegations, as others might?
In some measure, my response, if I'm speaking to someone or an audience that is willing to listen and be rational, is to say, none of us in this endeavor who understand the threat from this doctrine that we identify as Islamic law, Sharia, understand our work as anti-Islamic, because it isn't. As long as the Muslim or the Islam that one is speaking about is one that is not adherent to the doctrine. And there are plenty of Muslims around the world and the globe who don't. What we have simply done is uncover the doctrine, the motivating force behind the jihadists around the globe, and again, whether they're the kinetic or the stealth jihadists, and exposed it for what it is. And that can be frightening. You'll recall, and I can't remember his name, who was the fellow that was at the Treasury Department when you and I went and sat with all the bigwigs at the Treasury Department when we were giving them a briefing on Sharia-compliant finance. As many of your audience might recall, there was a period in time in which the American the government had taken over AIG that was going under, and in doing so was literally running AIG Sharia compliant finance businesses around the globe, and many other banks were toying with the idea that they would start marketing these various Sharia-compliant finance instruments, whether they were loans or bank accounts, in order to tap into this wealth in the Gulf that was feeding so many sovereign bonds. And you would arrange for a briefing.
His name was Robert Kimmett. He was the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury at the time.
Right. And who was the individual who was in charge of tracking financial terrorism? That was the individual that I was really mostly speaking to.
I confess I'm not coming up with his name at the moment.
Yeah, he was in that position under several administrations. And I remember when we got done with the presentation, and he was the individual at the Treasury Department who was tasked with literally tracking the financing of global terrorism around the globe. And he looked to us and he said, David, I don't know anything about Islamic law, but I just can't believe what you say is true. And that was essentially their response. In other words, you have these individuals who've ginned up this Islamophobic industry, that if you criticize in any way, shape, or form any aspect of Islam, if you even simply point out the connection between jihad, this global terrorist movement, and Islam, you're an Islamophobe, you're a bigot, you're a hater, you're a racist. You have that group, but then you have this large group that makes them possible in the West, what was once termed in our day, Frank, the useful idiot. And these individuals are the ones in power. Right. These are the ones in power here that simply are not willing to look at the empirical data and connect the dots and understand what is going on.
So, David, let me cut to how we first met, which very much bears on what you've just described as your sort of personal history here. As I recall, a colleague of ours, Stephen Emerson, told me that he had learned of an individual who was going to be doing an undercover study of the mosques in the United States. This would have been in the mid-1990s, as I recall, for the purposes of exploring and validating or invalidating a theory, namely that there is a correlation between the Sharia adherent observation of Islam in mosques in the United States and their advocacy of jihad. And you're the guy that was going to do that. We met. I remember that first meeting as though it was yesterday, because what you described to me, which I really didn't appreciate, even though our Center for Security Policy had been studying the problem of jihadism in the United States and elsewhere around the world for some time, this central tenet that was really the wellspring of jihad, namely Sharia. Talk a little bit about that study, how you undertook it, and whether it validated your thesis or not.
Well, I also would say of Steve Emerson, a great hero in this battle. I'm forever grateful that he connected the two of us again.
Agreed.
We met, and I also remember that meeting. It was after 9/11 in the early 2000s. You and I had previously met in the late 80s and early 90s on related but different matters. What we looked at that point in time, right after 9/11, after having discovered this threat doctrine, Sharia was the underlying force, or as you put it, the rationale for global jihad. There were three things that we wanted to investigate. The first is, did this global doctrine, this threat doctrine, did it animate not only jihadist-type Muslims around the globe, and according to surveys, their supporters around the globe, had it infected a Muslim community in the United States at the institutional level, meaning that we weren't prepared yet to start looking at what individual Muslims per se believed in their hearts and souls when they went to their mosque and prayed. What we wanted to find out was this very pedigreed and institutionalized threat doctrine, a doctrine that was being taught in the various schools around the globe, that were being preached from the various mosques around the globe, that were embedded in the educational and outreach arms of Muslim institutions around the globe, had it infected the U.S. Muslim population? That was at its base one purpose. And the second purpose was to understand how that doctrine, if it was in fact finding its way into the Muslim institutions, the mosque in the main, which is the principal Islamic institution for Muslims around the globe and in the United States. It's a place of prayer. It's a place of education. It's a place of social community. How was that process taking place in those locations? And then finally, if we were correct that it had infiltrated into Muslim institutions in the United States, and it was doing this job at some level of effectiveness, we needed to be able to publicize that so that people in law enforcement and national security and otherwise could understand that connection. So we designed a study, and this was the study that we had embarked on at a preliminary level, and the one that you and I spoke about at that very fateful meeting in the early 2000s. And that is, we wanted to take a representative sample of mosques around the United States and measure two things. We were going to measure as the independent variable the level of Sharia adherence of that mosque. So we designed scales based upon Sharia, how adherent the mosque was to Sharia. was there separate men and women prayers? When was the dress aligned with the more fundamentalist Islamic doctrine, or was it more modern and contemporary? Were the facial hair, the beards of the men, did they align with more fundamentalist versus more contemporary? The literature in the mosque, was it Sharia adherent? Was it more contemporary? Or even to the extreme on the other side, was it calling for violent jihad against infidels? We had a variety of measures along various scales to measure that.
All of which were observable. So this is not subject to subjective judgment. This was basically something that you could empirically establish. And when you say it was representative mosques, David Yerushalmi, it was random sampled representative mosques. Is that right?
That is correct. We measured 100 mosques. And what we did is we had a procedure to randomly select 100 mosques across the country so that we weren't biased toward any geographic area. We weren't biased toward any particular level of adherence. It was purely a random selection. And what we did to get that was simply collect all the public information about mosque in every state and went through and randomly selected the mosque based upon that data pool. And the measure of these various scales of religiosity, of Sharia adherence, let's put it that way, were in fact objective. And they were designed to be so and observable after we left the mosque. So, for example, when it came to the lectures or the literature, we took samples and we had recordings. And every other way that we could empiricize the data so that it was measurable, observable, and replicable. So some other group of researchers could go in after us using the same design and determine that, yes, our study was both valid. We were measuring what we thought we were measuring and reliable, that the scale that we were using, the measuring tape, as it were, was accurate. The other variable was the religiosity versus the explicit call for jihad and violence. We embarked on that study after you and I sat down and discussed its protocols, its procedures, the purposes, and ultimately we together found the funding, because this would not be a easy study. We had to enlist individuals who, one, were properly trained and who understood the languages, because Muslim Americans in the mosque setting speak English, Arabic, Urdu, Farsi, languages from all over the globe. And that effort took some time to develop. And then it was about a year later that we were prepared to launch this thing formally, and we began the study. It took us approximately a year and a half to complete the study. We ultimately did it.
When you say study, this just to put a fine point on it, this involved undercover visits to these mosques and interactions with, in some cases, the leadership of the mosques, in other cases, attendees. Is that right?
That's correct. We had researchers, men and women, who were being trained by our team of senior researchers who were national security experts who had been involved in this field and who spoke the various languages. We had Muslim experts who were our professionals working with our team and liaisoning with them to train them and teach them what to be looking for and how to measure, how to pray, how to involve themselves in the mosque itself.
Yeah, a rebuttal to the idea that this was some Islamophobic undertaking.
Right. Most of our researchers were Muslims, and they had to be able to do this successfully. And these were Muslims who understood the threat from Sharia. They were in this country in the main because they had run away from the tyrannical environments where Sharia held sway.
That's such an important point, David. And again, having suffered, as we both have, among many others, these smears of various kinds about our views of Muslims or hostility towards them, the fact that you were able to enlist people who did not want to live under Sharia in America, a place to which, as you say, in many cases, they had fled to get away from it, is such a really important, I think, testimony to both the importance of your work and the validity of its findings. And let's just get to that quickly, because we've got so much else I want to talk with you about. So get to the conclusions of your study quickly, if you could.
I will. So what we discovered, and we didn't expect it to be this aligned, at the end of the day, and these results were written up and published in two peer-reviewed journals. They can be found online today. One is Perspectives on Terrorism, an international group of governments and universities that publish peer-reviewed work on the intersection between various doctrines, including Sharia, but others, and terrorism. And the second peer-reviewed journal was the Middle East Forum. What we learned was this. There was almost a one-to-one relationship, correlation, between Sharia adherence in U.S. mosques and the call and support of jihad violence against the infidels. And what that established was the understanding that in America, where most of the Muslims are peaceful and law-abiding, but their institution and the mosque is almost singularly the only institution of Muslims around the globe, but especially in the United States, their institutions were infused and permeated with this threat doctrine from the pulpits, the imams, even though the imam might be preaching to a bunch of doctors, lawyers, and accountants who stood straight back and strong when it came to the Pledge of Allegiance, they were inculcating and preaching to them and their children, most threateningly, this doctrine of Sharia and its nexus, its connection with violent jihadism or stealth jihad and the hatred of all things West. Those were the results.
In addition to that one-to-one correlation, the presence of Sharia supremacism, for want of a better term, and therefore the call to jihad in that random sample was extraordinarily high. What was that number?
89%. Essentially 9 out of 10 mosques in that period of time espoused within their four walls hardcore Sharia and violent jihad.
This brings us to a group that we haven't talked about to this point in this conversation, David Yerushalmi, but which became very much a focus of your investigative work, your legal work as well, and ours at the Center for Security Policy, namely the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is an organization that I think listeners to this call have heard about over the years, but give us a quick characterization of that group and its involvement in the mosque infrastructure of the United States, and the extent to which you see a further correlation between those 89 mosques, percent of the mosques that you sampled, for example, as well with the Brotherhood and its direction.
The Muslim Brotherhood, as you know, the Ikhwan, as it's referred to in Arabic, was an organization and a movement, really, that was begun in the early 20th century in Egypt, spread to Pakistan and around the globe. The Muslim Brotherhood, which oftentimes is at odds, apparently, with Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State types, the ones who want to confront the great Satan and the little Satan directly in war, jihad. But notwithstanding that apparent conflict, they align very closely with these groups these violent groups in the area of Sharia doctrine.
And let me ask you, the apparent conflict, David, I assume you're referring to what the then director of national intelligence, James Clapper, contended in formal testimony to Congress, was the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood had eschewed violence, which he took to mean that, you know, they were not only not a problem in terms of jihad, but they were our natural partners in combating al-Qaeda and other, you know, other examples of Sharia supremacism. Have I got that basically right, as the nature of the apparent conflict?
Yeah, basically. And this kind of scratches at the surface of the problems that we see today, and ultimately that you and I will talk about, I hope, toward the end of this hour. But the problem with the national security experts, like the individual who turned to us in the Treasury Department, said, I know nothing about Islam and Sharia, but it can't be what you said it is, right? So guys like Clapper and Brennan and others who know very little about Sharia or Islam truly come up with these rationalizations to attempt to give it a shine that isn't threatening, because for a lot of reasons, not the least of which, it'd be too mind-boggling if it was what we understand it to be and what it is. Or they literally embrace the kind of Muslim Brotherhood doctrine itself, which is they hate Western civilization, ultimately. But Clapper was wrong in the sense that, yes, there is a different tactic used by the Muslim Brotherhood. The apparent, and that's in scare quotes, conflict is no conflict at all. The Muslim Brotherhood, as a kind of modern version of al-Qaeda and the Islamic State types, is simply a Sharia-adherent, jihad-promoting Muslim in a suit and tie who understands the best way to destroy the West is not necessarily a head-on collision in war, although they certainly quietly applaud that effort. The best approach is to infiltrate the West using their liberty and their doctrines of freedom, and create and articulate a institutional infusion of Muslim Brotherhood type individuals into government, into public policy, into education, and pound on this constant criticism of the United States, Western civilization, and claim Islamophobia, a bigotry, a hatred, a victimization for Muslims, the narrative that we see from progressives regarding systemic racism, et cetera, and jump on board that progressive train, even though as Sharia adherent Muslims, the progressives would be the first to perish once they take power. And we've seen that, whether it was in Egypt during the first coup that threw Mubarak out and the Muslim Brotherhood took power, and every other country that has toyed with the idea of running their countries through Sharia adherence. The Muslim Brotherhood seeks to infiltrate all of these institutions. So if you want to find the Muslim Brotherhood, go to the prisons where felons are being indoctrinated into Muslim Brotherhood type gangs, teaching them how to use their violent, felonious backgrounds and skills in the name of Islam. If you want to find the Muslim Brotherhood, go to the colleges where they have Muslim student association groups that teach these young Muslim Americans who know nothing of Islam, really. They come from mostly non-religious backgrounds. They know something about Ramadan and fasting and the basic concepts, like many of the Jewish American students on campuses, or even the Protestants or Catholic students on campuses.
One point that's worth noting is, in many cases, I think it's fair to say, based on what we discussed earlier, these are children of Muslims who left someplace to get away from Sharia. So they may actually be having sort of a family tradition of a more secular kind of Islam. And what you're talking about is they're recruited and indoctrinated by Muslim brothers on campus to become more, well, Sharia compliant, more Sharia supremacists?
Well, that's exactly right. What we know from the profile of these Muslim students is indeed most of them came from very American, patriotic, successful, highly educated families. The demographics of Muslim Americans, at least through the early 2000s in this country, were fairly successful, integrated American families that were also Muslim, not unlike the Jewish demographic, where you saw the same kind of integration and assimilation. When they show up in college campuses, they have a sense of distance from their families, and they have strong nuclear families in most cases. And so they want to join some social group, some fraternity. Many of them turn to the Muslim Students Association, a Muslim Brotherhood organization. And what this group does is they take these young students in and they say, well, you think you're Muslim. Come on, what do you know? And then they start teaching them what true Islam is in their minds. And that's the Sharia doctrine. And many, not all, but certainly many of these students embrace that and suckle at this new source of knowledge that teaches them that they were raised in a country that's systemically racist, that hates Islam, that's Islamophobic, and here's how they can change this country and the world, the Muslim Brotherhood doctrine of stealth jihad, of going out, becoming successful, running for political office, working in high levels of government bureaucracy, whether at the state or federal level, becoming educators, and teaching this doctrine and embracing the other major threat doctrine that the West faced, this progressive view of Western civilization, that it was founded in evil, it's infused in evil, it is evil, and must be dismantled at all costs.
I want to turn to that progressive threat vector with you momentarily, David, but just one last question. In the course of your research, the undercover investigation you performed and subsequently, what was the evidence of Muslim Brotherhood penetration and even domination of another institution in our country, namely the mosques of the United States?
Well, one of the data points that we were looking for between Sharia adherence and the call for jihad, whether it's kinetic or stealth jihad, was literature that identified either violent jihad, or the corruption of society through this stealth jihad that we've identified with the Muslim Brotherhood. And more specifically, some of the literature that we had identified was Muslim Brotherhood literature, books and pamphlets that spoke about specifically the idea that Western civilization was the source of all evil, in that the idea of liberty, the idea that individuals should have the choice to live their lives according to their own religious doctrine, their own notions, as long as they were lawful, otherwise patriotic individuals, but should have that freedom to choose their own life's direction, that they understood, the Muslim Brotherhood groups that wrote this literature, and this is what the literature said, they understood it was Western liberty, notions of representative government that must be undermined and ultimately destroyed in order for Sharia and the caliphate, this global government run by Islamic doctrine, to take over the world. They understood that the greatest hindrance to their successful domination was concepts embedded in Western liberty. And that literature was one of the most predominant forms of violent or stealth jihad that we found in mosques across the country.
And you were able to some extent, identify these mosques as Muslim Brotherhood, even without the undercover work and analysis that went into it. And I want to just say, this was a tremendously labor-intensive and careful process. Especially, I recall vividly the statistical analysis that went into it to make sure you got it right, as well as, of course, the exacting quality control on the investigators' reporting and analysis. But I wanted to just say, when you see the term Islamic Society of, or Islamic Center of, fill in the blank, city, state, what have you, you have a tell, I think, David, generally, that that is a Brotherhood-affiliated mosque or mosque complex. Is that fair?
In the main, it is true, just empirically, because most of the mosques in the United States, and there's a doctrine of a trust that once an organization or a country or a piece of land is Islamic, it can never be transferred to infidels. It must remain Islamic ad infinitum. And so as a result, according to Sharia doctrine, a mosque should be held in a trust for Islam in perpetuity. And the United States has one main organization, but there's others, and these are run by Muslim Brotherhood types. And they literally own and control these mosques. So these names, and more importantly, the property ownership, that's all you really need to look at to know who is in control of this mosque. And indeed, you know, and over the years, notwithstanding my label of an Islamic bigot and racist and everything else by the Muslim Brotherhood and the progressives, we've represented many Muslims, individuals seeking asylum, patriotic individuals who, as we pointed out, run away from and want to resist the Sharia types. But we've also represented groups of Muslims who have come to us because they began a mosque, a very patriotic, Western-centered mosque. But typically what happens is the Muslim Brotherhood sends in individuals with deep pockets, whether they be Pakistani or from the Gulf Coast, and they start literally donating money and reestablishing a new board of directors that they control, and then turning the mosque over, which was owned by the small community of Muslim patriotic-minded Americans, turn it over to the trust, the Islamic trust, and take possession not just of the board of directors, but literally of the real estate in the building and control it in that way.
David, sadly, we are nearing the end of this conversation. I think what you've established is both the quality of the work you do and the importance of it to particularly the national security, I would argue to other aspects of, you know, our society as well. But I think there's no getting around it when you're talking about people whose explicit goal is to destroy our form of government and replace it with an Islamic caliphate. You're talking about a mortal threat, whether it's from outside or within the United States, to everything we hold dear. You've introduced the whole new topic of the allies of many of these groups who are self-described as progressives. I think you could also call them Marxists more often than not, even communists. But they're hard leftists who have forged what we've called at the Center for Security Policy over the years, the red-green axis, to advance perhaps with different outcomes in mind, but nonetheless a shared purpose, which is taking down the government of the United States and replacing it with something to their liking, whether it's the sort of workers' paradise, as the communists would have us believe, or the Sharia supremacist Islamic Republic or caliphate. That will be a topic, if you would indulge me, for another hour of conversation at some point soon. But I just wanted to close with an opportunity for you to talk briefly about the American Freedom Law Center, which has, as you say, been an instrumentality of trying to defend the freedoms of Muslims and a great many others that are being threatened by one or the other of these forces or both. And how people can learn more about that work, and I hope support it as well.
Well, thank you for that opportunity, and I look forward to the future opportunity to sit down with you and discuss this red-green axis, this symbiotic relationship between these progressives and the Muslim Brotherhood types. But to speak to the American Freedom Law Center, back when we were doing this study, and you and I were trying to educate Treasury officials and others about the threat from Sharia-compliant finance, I decided that we needed to do something in my area beyond just the public policy area, the litigation lawfare area, lawfare being the use of the courts and the law to protect the Constitution versus the way the Muslim Brotherhood and the left uses lawfare, which is to destroy the Constitution. And I came across another individual, a former combat Marine officer and judge advocate in the Marine Corps, who had dedicated a decade of his life to litigating mostly First Amendment issues, pro-life issues, free exercise of religion issues on behalf of Christians who were being discriminated against, oftentimes in favor of Muslims. And he and I joined forces. And over a decade ago, again, with the Center for Security Policy's assistance, established the American Freedom Law Center, otherwise referred to as AFLC. And that organization was predicated upon a Judeo-Christian understanding of Western civilization. Robert Muse, my colleague, former combat Marine officer and truly a dear friend, is a devout Catholic with 12 children, homeschooled. He's now a grandfather of, goodness, tens of grandchildren, and he's 10 years my junior. Myself, an Orthodox Jew, so it was the first time that a public, conservative, public interest law firm was going to come at this, not just as a group of conservative Christians, which you have many good groups of public interest law firms who come at it from protecting conservative / Christian values. You don't have any conservative Jewish organizations in this battle space, but we wanted to unite the two, the Judeo-Christian foundation of this country, and support the Constitution in the court and protect liberty. And we began and were involved together in suing the U.S. government for running Sharia-compliant financial institutions, i.e. the AIG, the big insurance carrier and financial institution that was collapsing at the time of the great bank collapse in this country. And from there, we've gone on to do battle in just about every area, whether it's against the Muslim Brotherhood, and we've successfully sued the main Muslim Brotherhood organization in this country, the Council on American Islamic Relations, otherwise referred to as CARE. We've been involved in pro-life issues, mostly Robert, who had really established himself as the premier litigator in this pro-life area, and both trial courts and appellate courts. We represent one of the largest and most successful pro-life Catholic groups, Priests for Life, in the United States as general counsel, and have represented them in the Supreme Court when Obamacare came along and tried to mandate to devout Christians that they had to engage in providing these abortion-related services through insurance and so forth. And we have got involved recently as well in the battle against progressives on many different fronts, including the school boards.
David, we're out of time, I'm afraid, before we can do justice to your unbelievable history of service in so many of these fights. We will come back to it, though. I am privileged. I consider it one of the greatest achievements of my life to have had a small hand in helping get the American Freedom Law Center started, and I proudly serve on its advisory board, have from the inception of it, and thank the world of both you and Rob Muse and the accomplishments that have been achieved as a result of your extraordinary skills as both litigators and profoundly convicted patriots. And I am so appreciative for the chance to visit with you at length about some of these policy and legal fights, lawfare being, again, your battle space of extraordinary achievement. But thank you for taking the time to go through some of your work to date. Congratulations on all of it. And do let's regroup soon to finish up as best we can this picture of a nation under assault and what you and your team at AFLC and your partnering with others like the Center for Security Policy are doing about it. And Godspeed, my friend, in the meantime. I know, because without saying, you'll keep up the great work. I hope the rest of you will come back to us, not only for that further conversation with David Yerushalmi, but for tomorrow's programming. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks so much for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.